May 11th, I call the House Judiciary Committee to order Wednesday. We're going to go ahead and start at the top of the agenda. Senate Bill 178 will open a public hearing. Staff?
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 178 removes the requirement for the Bureau of Labor and Industries to compare state and federal wage rates and make the results available. It directs public agencies to include a provision for payment of higher wage rate by contractors and subcontractors in public works contracts. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Let's have Kate Newell come up, Brian Creek, and Sean Miller. Please.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kate Newhall with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 178, which is a concept from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. It's actually pretty simple and pretty straightforward. It deletes the requirement that BOLI produce what we call our double rate book. So what is our double rate book? I believe I brought it around to some of you in the offices. It is a publication that BOLI has a statutory obligation to produce each year that compares state and federal prevailing wage rates. The idea behind this publication was to make it easier for contractors to know which the higher of the state or federal prevailing wage was, so that when they were working on projects that were covered by both state and federal prevailing wage law, it would be easy to determine what the appropriate rate to pay was. The problem with the prevailing wage rate book is that it is a somewhat cumbersome publication. It's also out of date almost the moment it's printed. The reason that is that whereas in Oregon, we update our prevailing wage rates at all trades, all regions, at two predictable points in the year, in January 1st and July 1st. The U.S. Department of Labor, on the other hand, updates their rates as often as 20 times a year, and they do it somewhat sporadically by a particular trade in a particular region. So all the way through this book, there is a disclaimer on the top of every single page that says federal wage rates can change at any time. To consult the U.S. Department of Labor's webpage to ensure that that rate is actually correct. So what I think it winds up with in the end, though, is a publication that is confusing, misleading, and potentially could put contractors in a place where they're not accessing the accurate information if they're just looking at this book and they're not going to the U.S. Department of Labor's website as well. So each year in putting together this publication, we have about 500 staff hours go into producing it. And again, because it's out of date the moment that it's printed, we do a really short print run on it, and it costs us about $11 per book to produce. So Senate Bill 178 simply deletes the requirement that we produce this rate book. In working with stakeholders, we also decided that it probably was a good idea to include that all state contracts include in it a provision so that the contractors were absolutely aware that they were responsible for paying the higher of the two rates if it was a dual-covered project. So in the end, Senate Bill 178 is something that we worked with both stakeholders in state agency contracting land, but also with trades and contractors. We brought it to our prevailing wage advisory committee. It was met with overwhelming support by all of the members of our advisory committee, because I think everybody agrees that it is a confusing and misleading publication. So with that, I urge your passage of Senate Bill 178, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors, and I also serve as the co-chair of the Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee at BOLI and in support of Senate Bill 178. And as Kate mentioned, the minute this book is printed, it is out of date. From the construction contractor side, it gives contractors out there a false sense of security if you're actually just going to completely rely on this book for the rate, which you cannot do. And unfortunately, you can't use that as a defense if you pay the wrong prevailing wage. And so, as you could see, we are supportive of eliminating this costly book. It doesn't eliminate the law or change the law. Actually, that law, I think, went into effect when Representative Shoffler and his committee a few sessions ago, or several sessions ago, but it does eliminate the book, and we do support that. I do want to say that the emergency clause is important part of this bill, and the reason is the BOLI currently is underway, or they should be starting building the next book, and so I think passage of this bill now is important, along with the emergency clause, because we don't want to waste another $11 per book on something that we can't use, and so I urge your passage. Thank you.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Brian Krieg, today representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. I'd like to echo the comments that were made before me. This is a good streamlining bill. It'll help avoid potentially making an error. It'll make it easier to comply and for compliance work by the BOLI. And, hey, it's environmentally friendly going paperless. So please vote for the bill. Thank you.
Committee members, any questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to recess this bill for just a moment. We'll be coming back to it, so recess Senate Bill 178 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 347. Representative Brewer.
Chairs and members of the committee, Senate Bill 347A exempts records of individuals and their family members who seek assistance from domestic violence service providers from disclosure as public records. It declares an emergency as effective on passage. Records currently, records maintained by domestic violence service providers, resource centers, or shelters that are operated by or in partnership with a public entity are subject to disclosure as public records. This bill allows them to be kept confidential.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Katie Air Brewer, representative from House District 29. Thank you to the co-chairs and committee members for this hearing. I really appreciate it. I also wanted to draw your attention to Senator Dianne Rosenbaum's written testimony that's been handed in previously, who is the chief sponsor of this bill. This bill is specifically about domestic violence resource centers and sexual assault resource centers that are in a joint private-public partnership and the public disclosure laws around that. Because of the public element of them, they are the clients of these centers are subject to public disclosure rules. This bill specifically exempts the client's information from public disclosure rules, which is, I believe, highly critical for these centers so that, such as the model that is operating now, the Gateway Center up in Multnomah County, that the clients can avail themselves of these services. We're doing the exact thing we want our governments to do, which is outsource services to third parties for dollar savings and meet a public need here. But we need to make sure that we can protect these victims / survivors from their abusers and not have this information be made available to their abusers. And so this bill tries to, or this bill is intended specifically in those narrow cases to keep that information out of public disclosure laws. To my understanding, no media is in opposition to this very narrow application, and I urge you to pass this to the floor.
Any members, any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and finish this bill. We only have two more people on it. Beth Wooten and Martha Morris, please.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Beth Wooten. I'm a University of Oregon law student, and I have experience in domestic violence law, and I've been working with the city of Portland on this bill. It is my pleasure to be before the committee today to speak in support of SB 347. SB 347 is narrowly crafted. It's a provision that's needed to protect domestic violence survivors and families in Oregon. Under current law, any public agency is subject to a public records request. Therefore, any and all client records maintained by these shelters, such as the Gateway Center in Portland, could be released at any time as part of a public records request. The Gateway Center is a fantastic combination of resources for survivors and their children, but as a project of the county, Gateway is an example of one of these DV centers subject to public disclosure. And this prevents them from providing the full extent of victim services they are capable of. This is why we need this bill. It is a very specific exception that would allow public agencies like Gateway to track client visits. It would allow confidentiality between employees, volunteers, and domestic violence survivors. so they may communicate freely without putting the client at risk. As someone who has worked with domestic violence survivors in Lane County, I have seen how important trust and confidentiality is in the process of a survivor's recovery. Confidentiality provides that supportive safe space that's needed for the client and also keeps the service center informed and responsive to the client needs. And this transition away from abuse certainly is a process. So often these clients have financial, legal, medical, family, several different concerns, and we're talking about more than just one or two visits. So if a DV center cannot keep record of the client's information and the needs on file, this really impairs their ability to provide assistance and support specific to the client. SB 347 answers this issue of public records requests without conflicting with any public information needs. Newspaper publishers have come out in support of this bill. The bill would not affect any subpoena process. It would not conflict or complicate any court rules of evidence. Also, it does not overlap or interfere with the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA. It complies with that. In fact, most DV advocacy centers are not HIPAA-covered entities for the most part. And national domestic violence advocacy groups, such as Family Violence Prevention Fund, recommend that state legislatures enact privacy laws similar to this bill to protect families in their state. And Oregon is already recognized by many of these agencies as a state with higher privacy standards. So closing this gap with Senate Bill 347's enactment would be consistent with Oregon's ongoing efforts to help and protect domestic violence survivors and their families. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Greetings, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Martha Strawn Morris. I'm the director of the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services, and I thank you for your consideration of this bill. I think we're doing wonderful work at the Gateway Center. We're meeting a really unique need by operating in a public facility, a published location. We see about 20 folks coming every day to visit to explore their options for reaching safety and stability with our 16 different direct service agencies all housed under the same roof. We've had almost 2,400 visits to the center since we opened in September by close to 1,200 unique individuals. Almost 60% of the people who come to the center are coming for a return visit because, as Beth said, the needs are complex often, and it takes more than one visit. Sometimes people are coming in planning stages. They want to talk about things. They're raising their consciousness about how their levels of safety in their relationship. And so we're there if they're coming back after a week or 2 weeks or 2 months or even a year, and we'd like to be able to track their visits over time. We do believe that that would allow us to serve the individual better. But importantly, I think it's also going to allow me to develop a clearer picture of which interventions are providing the maximum benefit. What package of services can we have on hand to really help people reach and maintain stability? I think from a public policy level, I can do a much better job painting a clearer picture of how we can best use our finite resources to serve this population if I can track them over time. So again, I really appreciate your consideration.
Any members, do you have a question?
I don't have a question. Thank you very much for your testimony. I just want to say I received a call from City Commissioner Dan Saltzman, who wanted to be here today to testify on behalf of this, but was unable, and he asked me to relay that his strong support for this bill.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 347 and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 178. And Greg Miller and John Krakowitz.
Thank you, Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Greg Miller, representing the Oregon State Building Construction Trades Council and the National Electrical Contractors Association, here to support the bill. I think my friends that went before me framed the issue fairly well, so I'll keep my comments brief. But this bill does eliminate what can be a confusing and misleading document. The elimination of this helps folks put together bids that are consistent and correct, and we appreciate the effort.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is John Rakowitz with AGC, Associated General Contractors. I'm also here in support of this bill. It we actually view it as a government efficiency bill. As things currently stand, as Kate from Boley outlined, the document and the requirement in the law to produce that document can actually cause real confusion. And so we'd rather have Boley staff working on correct information, providing the kind of technical assistance that they can provide, and use that time for that, and make sure contractors are aware at all points in time of what their requirements are under the law. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Any members have any questions, concerns? Thank you. Close a public hearing on Senate Bill 178 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 592.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 592 allows an award of attorney fees for appeals of administrative decisions. Oregon statutes that allow or require awards of attorney fees in civil actions are construed to allow awards for the appeal of those actions so long as the underlying action commenced in a court. That's a case law decision that alters Oregon statutory law. Senate Bill 592 would also ensure that an award of attorney fees for appeals of underlying administrative decisions. We also received a dash A3 amendment today that further insulates the same idea by adding the language other appellate review, as I understand it. I haven't yet summarized it. We just got it today, but it should be available to everybody.
Okay. Have Russ, Mel, and John come up, please. Didn't use Chandler's last name. He wasn't certain who I was talking about.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Russ Lepetsky. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. My practice is limited to family law in the trial court and the appellate court. This bill actually came concurrently with a House bill that was put on hold when we realized that there was an identical Senate bill working through, and it's a Senate bill now that you have before you. My issue in this bill, or my concern about this bill, and it's mostly reflected in the dash 3 amendments that you have before you, is to clarify that when there is already statutory authority at the lower court level for an award of attorney fees in a case, that authority flows upward through the appellate process, including the Court of Appeals, petitions for review to the Oregon Supreme Court, mandamus actions, and anything that happens in the appellate court levels, that authority that already exists at the lower court level extends up to the appellate level. That is the general rule, but there was an Oregon Supreme Court decision that came out in December that gave a what I consider a little strained interpretation of the statute, and concluded that, at least in a domestic relations case, there was no authority to award attorney fees in defending an unsuccessful petition for review. So the dash 3 amendments are intended to encompass what I believe is intended by the bill, and I've been working with Representative Garrett's office on this, that this authority for attorney fees flows up through all those different types of proceedings. This does not in any other manner create a new substantive authority for an award of attorney fees in a case. It just clarifies that where that authority exists at the trial court level or the administrative level, it flows up through the appellate level in all senses.
My name is Mel Stewart, Chairman, members of the committee. This is just a simple ripple up provision that when you get to appellate review, the court looks to whence the case came, and gives the court the same level of discretion to award attorney's fees. Either they shall be awarded, or they can be, or they may be awarded, and it gives the appellate courts the same level of authority from which the case came. This is particularly important in land use cases. There are a number of land use provisions that in some cases award attorney's fees against a party that acts badly. Right now, if a party acts badly and attorney's fees are awarded against them, or they're asked to pay attorney's fees, they still have the option to simply file an appeal. That appeal ties up the person's property maybe for another year, and there's no authority there to award attorney's fees. So the person that has their property wrongfully tied up has to pay his own attorney's fees and have his property tied up for much another year. That's unfortunate. The statutory provision, 19.440, was originally enacted in 1981 at the request of the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and written by the council, for the Judiciary Committee, and they used the word appeal. So at that point in time, the word was appeal. Yeah, appeal was used in its Webster's Dictionary sense, meaning just to go from a lower tribunal to review by an upper tribunal. Over that 30 years, the word appeal, the definition has migrated a bit. And in the land use statutes, originally the word appeal also appeared in OS 197. But about 7 or 8 years ago, through a housekeeping amendment by the Oregon Trial Court Administrator, they went in and changed the word appeal to judicial review. They didn't intend to wipe out the appellate legal fees provision, but it was an accident. They did.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of this bill. Mr. Stewart was delicate in his story. He has a longer and more compelling version. This creates or fixes what's often called in legal circles a trap for the unwary. This simply, as was already stated, does not create any new rights. It simply takes what we believe the law should have been in the first place until the rewrite that Mr. Stewart mentioned and allow those, whatever rights existed to attorney's fees at a lower tribunal, be it an administrative proceeding or the circuit court, to flow upward through judicial review of those creates that's more equitable, we believe. We think it's a good bill. Came out of the Senate unanimously. We commend it to you today. We're glad to take any questions.
Committee, you have any questions?
Representative Hicks? Mr. Chairman, it says Senate floor vote 29-1.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one was excused.
I thought you were going to say it was Cruz.
No, he was carrying it, Mr. Chairman. It would have been a good trick.
Anything further? Okay, thank you very much. We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 592 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 731.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 731A modifies obligation of evidence custodians to retain biological evidence as follows. For 60 years or until death of each person convicted of aggravated murder, rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, or unlawful sexual penetration in the first degree, until completion of sentence by each person convicted of aggravated vehicular homicide, manslaughter in the first degree, or manslaughter in the second degree, and until the statute of limitations has expired for charges that do not result in conviction. Requires a court to return admitted biological evidence to the responsible custodian or the defense as appropriate, provides a procedure to address lost or destroyed biological evidence, prohibits reversal of conviction on the sole ground that the biological evidence is no longer available, requires Attorney General to adopt rules pertaining to evidence collection in consultation with the Department of State Police and evidence custodian, provides a process for alternative dispute resolution, repeals a sunset, declares emergency as effective on passage. This measure is the most recent in a series of measures that provide a framework for dealing with DNA evidence. Oregon revised statutes contain provisions for the collection and retention of such evidence for missing persons and provide a means for the use of DNA evidence in post-conviction relief proceedings. This, in 2009, Senate Bill 310A passed, affecting a moratorium on the destruction of DNA evidence in certain criminal cases, and this measure is the product of an interim work group that refines the provisions of Senate Bill 310A and lifts the moratorium.
I don't need to testify.
Rose between teeth bones.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Andrew Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, pleased to be here in support of Senate Bill 731. Cheyenne gave a very good summary. I provided written testimony. I'm not going to read it, but I do want to cover a little bit of ground. And first is to thank Cheyenne because she organized and kept the work group on task. And ultimately, there was no opposition. And I will read only one portion of my testimony, which is who was part of this work group. It included evidence custodians from the cities of Lake Oswego, Medford, Eugene, and Portland, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, the Association of Oregon Counties, the League of Oregon Counties, Cities, excuse me, the Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division, the Oregon Justice Department, the Oregon Sexual Assault Task Force, the Innocence Project, and us, as well as Representative Barker, who attended most of the meetings. As Cheyenne covered, this is a part of a larger history, and I just want to briefly go over that because I think it's new for most of you, which is about a decade ago, Oregon passed what we call a DNA innocence law that allows people who've gone through post-conviction process for certain types of crimes to be able to request testing of biological evidence that either that technology had either not existed or sufficiently existed to test that type of evidence at the time. And one of the things we all know is that even evidence that contains biological material that cannot be tested today might be able to be tested tomorrow. So after that law was passed and ultimately the sunset removed, I had been asking the question for many years, but is the evidence kept? Because you can't request testing of evidence that has not been kept. And so the effort began last session and culminated in a work group spending a lot of time and coming up with this law, which dovetails nicely the innocence law. And I think Oregon is probably about the 25th or 30th state to join this effort, and there's a broad range, and I think we fall in the middle. But as explained, this sets up a system to preserve evidence for certain types of crimes, first-degree murders and sex crimes, aggravated vehicular homicide or manslaughter in the first or second degrees, and then for unsolved crimes of the covered offenses until the expiration of the statute of limitations. There are some protections in place for the custodian clerks to make sure that this process is doable. It does allow the retention of a smaller quantity of if the evidence is in bulk, is in such large quantity or size that it's difficult for it to be stored, so it has a process for them without permission of anyone to handle that type of evidence. It then has a process for, as was explained, rules to be drafted to more specifically on the details of this by the Attorney General with the input of the Oregon State Police and others who are actually handling this. But the goal is to set up a system that allows the custodians and property clerks and individuals in law enforcement to know what evidence they need to keep, how long they need to keep it, and what evidence they don't need to keep. And so I am happy to answer any questions, but we are most pleased to bring this bill forward and urge you all to support it. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on this issue.
Chair Krieger and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, also here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 731. This was a good work group process. The state of Oregon desperately needs a clear policy on evidence retention so that those who are responsible for being custodians of the evidence have clear and bright lines in terms of what they're to do with the evidence and how they're to handle it, and what they're to keep and what they can dispose of and how. And we believe this was a process that helped discuss this in light of the varying needs that occur from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So as you note, there were a number of evidence custodians from the Oregon Property Officers Association, other law enforcement personnel, and those that are involved at every level of both criminal investigation and the treatment of the evidence. And we took a look at this in light of both small and large agency needs. They're different. And also to look at those who are being accused of crimes, their needs as well. And I believe that this is a well-written policy, and it was a product of a very good work group discussion. It was active, and I feel like we landed in a place where we all feel very good about the result, and I'd encourage you to support Senate Bill 731. Thank you.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, my name is John C. Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Just want to echo what Ms. Meyer and Mr. Campbell have said. The sheriff strongly support the bill, and the sheriff who worked in the work group wanted me to publicly thank Ms. Meyer for the process whereby every entity involved in the group did not agree with everything, and everybody gave a little, and we worked a long time in the interim and came up with a good bill that everybody can support.
in the bill, the staff measure summary, it talks, provides procedure to address loss or destroy the biological evidence.
Discuss the procedure. In a situation, let me find it so that, and I don't know if you've got the section in front of you.
Five.
Section what, five?
Five.
Okay. No, that's, I think what you're asking for is what happens if the defendant requests the evidence and it cannot be found. And that's somewhere in here, and I apologize for stumbling over it, but let me find where I reference that so I can be accurate in telling you what exactly it does. If the evidence can't be found, the custodian must sign an affidavit setting forth the steps taken to locate it, and only if the court finds that the evidence was destroyed maliciously may the court impose appropriate sanctions and remedies. We purposely left that broad, but we also made it clear in the statute that no matter the reason for lost evidence, the court may not, based solely on those grounds, order reversal of a prior conviction. And I believe that is set forth in Section 1 of the bill.
That's correct. My apologies for misrecording you. Section 5. That's on page 2, starting lines, approximately line 20 to the end of the page.
But that is the process to ensure that we will trust the custodians to make good faith efforts and ensure that that happens, and only in the most, where we can establish an egregious situation, which we do not expect to happen in Oregon, but has sadly happened in some other jurisdictions.
Okay, committee members, any questions, comments?
Chair, on this side of the dais earlier, we were pondering those billboards that declare tomorrow to be the end of the world, May 12, 2011. And now that we see these three all together on the same side of the
may happen today.
Different side of the apocalypse.
Chair Krieger, Representative Hicks, stick around a few sessions. This isn't the first. It won't be the last. And I have no comment on the what will happen on May 20th.
You have a question?
So, Kevin, is the shift here with Senate Bill 731, is that in compliance with, or meets the goals of what CALEA standards are?
Chair Kringer and Representative Olson, I believe it does, actually. There's a number of policies similar to this around the nation now. They vary in some degree or another, but I believe that the policy that we would adopt in Oregon, and I would mention that I think now we only have one or two CALEA accredited agencies in the state, but we do have instead the Oregon Accreditation Alliance, which is now accredited at, I think, around 45 agencies. We would draft our policies and best practices to work within the structure of the statute.
And Chair Krieger, Representative Olson, if I can just add one piece. The reason we didn't put down in statute how evidence should be retained is because it is an evolving issue. Right. For instance, there's now talk that maybe you don't need to refrigerate. So letting the AG have guidelines that continue to evolve and provide not only the best practices, but we also hope the least and with the least onerous, and that they will actually become less onerous as time goes by. So that's why we actually chose very specifically not to put anything in statute about how.
That's good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 731, and I believe we're done for the day. So we'll close.